The middle chapter of this unit is something, its title from this book that this is from is called The Molecular Basis of Inheritance, which it will come to no surprise to anyone alive now that we're talking about DNA. DNA is the molecule of inheritance. We've known that for a while now, but really not all that long within the history of science. It's only within the last several decades that we've actually known that DNA is the molecule of inheritance, meaning it is what gets passed on and allows offspring to have traits that are similar to parents. It's not just for humans, for all organisms. Well, we've noticed that inheritance happens for thousands of years, of course. All you have to do is observe the world to realize that offspring resemble in many ways, not just visually, but they have traits similar to their parents or parent, if there's only one. So that was nothing new, but we haven't been able to explain it for most of those thousands of years. It's reasonable, though, to think that there is a material, a substance, in other words, that gets passed on from parents to offspring. In other words, it's reasonable to assume that there is a molecule of inheritance. But just because that makes sense doesn't mean you can say it scientifically. You have to demonstrate it. And that's really only been recently done. Seems like a long time in your lifetime, but it's not really all that long ago. Well, besides taking a closer look at molecularly at DNA and how it works, we're going to look at a couple important experiments, milestone experiments, that were important in figuring out inheritance, and specifically what kind of molecule caused inheritance. Starting out with the experiment that's summarized in slide one. Now, this is the so-called Griffiths experiment. You don't have to remember the name of the primary scientist, but this is nothing about DNA as far as what we learned from it. The importance of the Griffiths experiment is that it was the first experiment to clearly show that there is a molecule of inheritance, that it's not just some mysterious force that causes inheritance, but an actual substance. This does not at all say what the substance is. But what's happening in the experiment is that they worked with mice, non-volunteer mice, which were injected with bacteria, but it was the same bacterial species, but there were two different strains of it, or subspecies in a sense. The so-called S cells and the so-called R cells, those were the two versions of this bacterium. And the S cells are the dangerous ones. They are virulent. They cause disease. It causes pneumonia and the organism dies. The R cells do not. They are non-virulent. So they don't cause the disease. And so there's a few controls here in the experiment. They're not really surprising, but let's go through them. The first is that some mice were injected with living S cells. Those are the dangerous ones. And so it shouldn't surprise you that the mice died because they contracted pneumonia. And the ones that were injected with living R cells survived, as you would expect, because the R cells do not cause the disease. So no big surprise on these first two. In this third control, they used S cells, which are the dangerous ones, but before injecting them, they heated it up to kill the bacteria. And that's really also not surprising, because when you inject dead bacteria into the mouse, it doesn't cause the disease. It's because living organisms, the living bacteria, are what cause the disease. So that's really not surprising either. But the fourth one is the interesting one. Here they used dead, heat-killed, dangerous S cells that they then mixed with living R cells. So the only thing alive here are the harmless ones, the harmless bacteria. But when they injected that mixture, the mice died. And that's the importance of the experiment, because this showed for the first time that there seems to be some material causing traits in organisms. Specifically, the material that was released by these dead S cells was somehow causing the traits of the R cells to turn into S traits. And therefore, the mice died. Really, what's happening here is a demonstration of what's called bacterial transformation, which you'll probably learn more about in 182. But what transformation is that, well, bacteria have DNA like any organism, and their normal DNA contains genes for them to produce the proteins necessary for them to live. Cells are dying all the time, and when that happens, cells more or less collapse and spill their DNA out into the environment. That's just naked DNA, as it's called. It's no longer part of a cell. It's just molecules in the environment. And bacteria, if the conditions are right, can actually take up naked DNA from the environment and start using it as though it's their own DNA, even if it's not from a bacterium, just DNA in general. And that's exactly what was happening here. By killing the R cells, those cells exploded in the heat, spilled out the DNA that coded for the proteins that made them virulent. But that DNA was taken up by the non-virulent R cells, and they started using it as their own DNA, meaning they transcribed it and then translated the RNA and made the proteins that led to the disorder. Now, they didn't know that detail at the time. That's why I said does not say that DNA is the genetic material. This just shows for the first time that there is apparently some material that is responsible for inheritance, for traits. And, of course, the next big question after you say that there is a genetic material is, what is the material? Well, that was someone else's job later on to figure out. But the Griffiths experiment posed that question, basically. And so, before I describe slide 2, which is another experiment, another famous experiment, let me just say what was happening here. Once we showed that, with the Griffiths experiment in the previous slide, that there is a genetic material, scientists, biologists started making guesses as to what it is. And it could be any particle, right? But just so that to make things more efficient in testing, they kind of said what is more likely than other things. For instance, they said it's probably not water or oxygen that's doing this, right? They kind of discounted all these simple molecules and said, well, it's likely going to be one of the four categories of biological macromolecules, which we already knew about at this time. We knew the four categories. So they said it was probably one of those. But then they just went through those one at a time and picked out the most likely ones. Now, they didn't think that it was probably not going to be polysaccharides. For one thing, because they pretty much knew what polysaccharides were all about, what they were doing already at that time. And it's not that they couldn't, it's not that polysaccharides couldn't be the genetic material, they just said it probably isn't because we know about what it does. And they also discounted lipids, saying it's probably not lipids, they're not as complex as the other macromolecules, they're not true polymers, so that's probably not the case either. So they focused on the other two, which are polypeptides, proteins, and nucleic acids, polynucleotides. Now, at the time, most biologists predicted that it was going to be proteins. And that was because of something I've been telling you already, namely that proteins have by far the greatest variety in their molecular makeup. They have about any shape you can imagine, you can make a protein have that shape. And so the reasoning was anything that is controlling such a complex thing as heredity must itself be a very complex molecule, and so it's probably proteins. But the reason that they still included polynucleotides or nucleic acids in the mix was largely because even though we knew they existed, we didn't really know what they did yet. So they said, we don't know what these things are, maybe they are as well. Narrowed it down to those two, though. Proteins and nucleic acids. And that brings us to this famous experiment, which demonstrates that it's one of those two and not the other. It's a really well-designed experiment. But what we have in this picture is just a little part of the surface of a cell. So this is we're really zoomed in here because this brown material is a bacterial cell, which is a small cell, but we're so close up that this one very small cell is bigger than the building. We're looking at just a tiny bit of its surface. And these teal-colored things that look like aliens, sci-fi aliens, are viruses attached to the surface of the bacterium. And specifically, these viruses are examples of what we call bacteriophages. Which is a word that means eat bacteria. Right. Phage is the same root as in sarcophagus. It means eat. Importantly, though, a bacteriophage is not a bacterium. A bacteriophage is a virus that infects a bacterium. And it doesn't actually eat it, even though that's what the name really means. Now, a virus is a very simple structure compared to a cell. Remember, at the beginning of the term, I asked you whether a virus was alive or not. And it's not. Why is a virus not alive? Why is it not an organism? Well, that is true. What about structurally? What is it lacking that every organism has to have? It lacks the ability to reproduce on its own, but I'm talking about a structure. What's the structural requirement, the minimum structural requirement for being an organism?
Cell.
Right. You're not an organism unless you have at least one cell. A virus isn't close to being a cell. A cell is very much bigger and more complex than a virus. A virus, when you get down to it, molecularly speaking, is just a couple macromolecules. Specifically, it is a nucleic acid DNA or RNA, depending on the virus. In this case, it's a DNA-based virus. But that's one molecule, that's one macromolecule, DNA, and then that's wrapped in a protein, the capsule that gives it its shape. That's protein surrounding the DNA. And that's it, in the simplest cases, like this bacteriophage. And this is exactly why these scientists chose this. They're trying to answer the question, after assuming that it was one of them, is the genetic material DNA or is it protein? So it's perfect choice to use something that is made up of only those two things. All right, what you see here is that when a virus attaches to a bacterium, the change in shape of the protein injects the DNA into the cell. That's the infection that occurs. All right? Now, they didn't know that. They didn't know which of the two things gets injected into the cell, and that's what the whole idea of designing the experiment is. Because whatever gets injected is the genetic material, right? That's what causes a change in the bacterium. The other thing is just left behind. It's not the genetic material. So here's what they did. Slide 3. They used radio labeling. Radio labeling refers to marking molecules with atoms that are radioactive. This uses isotopes. Do you remember what an isotope is? Isotopes are different versions of the same element. So they have to have the same number of protons, otherwise they would not be the same element. But they have different numbers of neutrons. And so there's different versions of each of the elements. Well, some of those versions isotopes are radioactive. They will emit radiation, and therefore you can detect that radiation. This is what's so valuable about this. The radioactivity allows them to keep track of where that material is, because they can detect the radiation. So they use two batches here, represented by the pink and the blue flasks. In one, they had radioactive sulfur, S35. And that was not a random choice. It was a very reasoned choice. The reason they used sulfur is because sulfur occurs in some amino acids. Remember, we talked about cysteine having sulfur that comes together with another cysteine forming a disulfide bridge. So proteins, since they're made of amino acids, contain sulfur, but DNA does not. So it's a perfect choice. By making copies of this in radioactive sulfur, when that's the only sulfur available, that means the radioactivity is going to get incorporated into just the protein part, not the DNA part. All right? For batch 2, the blue one, they use radioactive phosphorus. And even though it is possible for proteins to contain phosphorus, it's not all that much compared to DNA. DNA has a lot of phosphorus, right? Because every single nucleotide, which is one monomer of the millions in a DNA, has phosphorus because it has a phosphate group. So that was a good choice as well. Well, starting with these two batches, separately labeled for one or the other of the two materials that they're tracking, they exposed bacteria to the viral suspension and allowed them to be infected. And then they had to come up with a way to separate the shells, the empty shells that are left behind after the injection into the cell takes place. They had to do that because so that they could then separate the shells from the cells, which now contain whatever genetic material it is. And it turned out that the perfect tool for the job was just an ordinary bar blender that one of them had. because the bar blender mixes it vigorously enough to knock all these empty shells off the cell, but not so vigorously that it will explode the cells. Because if you explode the cells, then everything is mixed together again. And so that did a perfect job. They did that for both the pink and the blue. And then they took the liquid in each batch and put it in a centrifuge, spun it down. The G-forces in centrifugation causes the heavier things to drop to the bottom. Well, by far, the heaviest thing in this liquid is the cells themselves. They are much huger than a single molecule, of course, because they're millions of molecules big. So the pellet at the bottom in both of these is going to contain the cells. All right? And the supernatant, as it's called, the liquid that's floating above the pellet, the lighter stuff, is going to contain the shells that got knocked off of the cells in both cases, pink and blue. Then it was just a matter of looking at both test tubes to detect where the radiation is. Well, in the blue batch, the radiation was in the supernatant, in the shells. So this by itself says that protein, which is where the radioactivity is not the genetic material. It's not what is being injected into the cells. You see that? But agreeing with that is the fact that in the blue one, they detected the radiation in the pellet. So that said that DNA, which is what was labeled in the blue one, is what actually got injected. So this is nicely and elegantly designed, and it showed for the first time that DNA is the genetic material. That's what gets passed on and causes traits. Well, as convincing as these results are, it didn't convince all the biologists at the time. I told you they were expecting it to be proteins. And there were some biologists at the time who said, okay, well, this experiment tells me that DNA is the genetic material for something as simple as a bacterium. But for something complex like a human, it must still be proteins. It can't be something as simple as DNA. Well, it didn't take them long to come around. Of course, it's DNA for all organisms. Protein's important for all kinds of other reasons, but it's not the genetic material. Okay, let's go to 4. Now, this is a tiny, tiny piece of DNA that we're looking at. Because a typical DNA polynucleotide is millions of nucleotides long. We're seeing only 4 nucleotides here, which is why it fades out at the top, the blueness, and at the bottom. It's just a tiny fraction of a very, very long chain of nucleotides, collectively called a polynucleotide. And remember, even though we've said this before, let's review, remember what a nucleotide as a single monomer contains. Even though it is a one-part thing, a nucleotide, it still contains 3 things. And to be a nucleotide, you have to have a nitrogenous base hooked to a pentose sugar. And also hooked to that same sugar, you have to have at least 1 phosphate. So this is a nucleotide, this is a nucleotide, this is, and this is. Okay, if all phosphates are the same, so the phosphate part of DNA doesn't have anything to do with the code, since there's only 1 version of phosphate. Now, there are 2 possible pentose sugars that are used in nucleic acids, remember, which are ribose and deoxyribose. But that's still not a source of variability within the polynucleotide, because if you're making DNA, every one of those sugars is going to be deoxyribose. And if you're making ribose, every one of them is going to be ribose. So neither the phosphate nor the pentose sugar has anything to do with the code either. The only thing that makes up the code is the variable part of the nucleotide, which is the nitrogenous base. And We originally talked about the fact that there are five nitrogenous bases used in nucleic acids, but each of the two categories of nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, uses only four of those five. That's why there's four shown here, by the way. It gives you one of each. And the nitrogenous bases used in DNA are thymine, adenine, cytosine, and guanine, T-A-C and G for short. That is what the code of a gene is, or any sequence of DNA. A gene is just a sequence of DNA, nucleotides. But the code is the actual nitrogenous base order. And it can be anything. There's nothing saying that a guanine has to be next to a cytosine. Any position can be occupied by any four nucleotides, any of the four possible ones. So it's exactly analogous to digits in a phone number, for instance, right? The difference is that there are 10 available digits, 0 through 9, and you can have a sequence of however many, like 10 in a phone number. So there's 10 to the 10th number of possible phone numbers in a 10-digit number. Well, you don't have 10 digits to work with. You have four here because there's four different kinds of nucleotides. But you have many more than 10 digits in the sequence. You have millions. And so the number of possibilities is 4 raised to millions, which is a ridiculously huge number. It just blows away the number that's equal to how many atoms there are in the universe. That's tiny compared to this. So that's where the code is. The information is in the actual sequence of nucleotides along the length of the DNA you're reading. Now, this is not a complete DNA. This is kind of confusing terminology, because when we say a single DNA, we're really talking about two molecules that are hooked together but remain separate molecules. Because a DNA, unlike RNA, DNA is usually double-stranded. Each strand is its own molecule. It's a molecule in its own right. Each strand is a polynucleotide. But the two strands are held together by non-chemical bonds. That's why they don't combine into just one big molecule. They remain two separate molecules but associated with each other. Exactly analogous to multimeric proteins, where the polypeptides in a multimeric protein remain individual molecules in their own right, but they're complex together to make the overall protein. Okay? So we're seeing only part of one half of a total DNA. But one DNA is actually two molecules, is what I'm saying here. And I think we've already talked about this, but we should review this as well. Notice that the part that gives DNA its information, which is the nitrogenous base sequence, does not in any way hold together the nucleotides in the sequence. Notice that each adjacent pair of nitrogenous bases are not connected to each other. The nitrogenous bases are just hanging off of the backbone, which is called the sugar phosphate backbone, because only those two parts of the nucleotides are involved in holding together the whole sequence of nucleotides. That's the blue shading. That's the sugar phosphate backbone, because the phosphate of one nucleotide is connected covalently, chemical bond, to the sugar of the next, and so on down the line. And that's really important, because the sugar phosphate backbone has to be strong. If it's not strong, this sequence will be lost. If this easily breaks, you lose the information, because now you don't have any idea what the sequence was if it breaks into bits. That's why it's important for the sugar phosphate backbone to be made up of covalent bonds, which are strong. Okay? Now, another thing, and I don't think we did talk about this, maybe we didn't, is that a single polynucleotide, however long it is, even if it's only four, like in this, or even one nucleotide, by the way. But however long the polynucleotide is, it has polarity. One end is different from the other, in other words. So we have what's called the 5' end at one end and the 3' end at the other. Now, the prime notation that we've looked at before in other examples refers to the carbon, but specifically, remember the carbons are numbered in a molecule, an organic molecule. Specifically, it's the carbons of the pentose sugar. So there are 5 carbons, obviously, in a pentose. Pentose is a 5-carbon sugar. 1, 2, 3, 4 make up the ring, and then the 5th one is hanging off the ring. So at the 5' end, connected to that carbon, you have a phosphate. You always have a phosphate at the 5' end. At the 3' end, you have a hydroxyl. Hydroxyl is connected to the 3rd carbon. All right? That's just a single polynucleotide, but a complete DNA is going to have another polynucleotide next to it. It will have a 3' end and a 5' end as well, but they are not going to match up. The 3' end of one polynucleotide is going to be next to the 5' end of the other one. So in other words, it's not going to be head-to-head and tail-to-tail. It's going to be head-to-tail for the two. Talk more about that in a minute. Let's go to slide 5, though, first. This picture of Rosalind Franklin is here because she was instrumental in figuring out what the shape of DNA is. So this is the time in history after that previous experiment I was talking about that showed DNA is the genetic material. So that answered the big question, what is the material? Then the big question became, how does DNA work as the genetic material? Well, you can't actually answer that efficiently until you first say, how is it shaped? Maybe we can figure out how it works after we first learn how it is shaped. So what's the structure of DNA was the next big question. And eventually, Watson and Crick got the Nobel Prize for this, two men, but they were helped by Rosalind Franklin a lot, who at the time, because of sexism, largely, did not get credit for anything, any of this. And she didn't really ever know that she was going to be credited because she died of cancer, in her 30s or early 40s, before people started giving her credit. But anyway, she helped Watson and Crick figure out the shape because she was an expert, a worldwide expert in X-ray crystallography. Now, crystallography is a technique that allows scientists to figure out the shapes of molecules. So molecules are too small, you can't get in there and look at them with a microscope. You have to indirectly figure out their shape. X-ray crystallography involves shining X-rays, which are light that's invisible to us, onto these molecules. And when the photons encounter the object, they get bent in various directions. They get diffracted, which is bending. And at the other end, after the molecule, there is X-ray film, just like there is for an X-ray for diagnosis. And then they develop the film and look at the pattern. That's why we're seeing this picture right here, which is a famous picture historically on the right. Now, it doesn't look like much to us, but to an expert like Rosalind Franklin, she said, this looks to me like we could be dealing with a helical structure. And so she suggested that to Watson and Crick, and then they were able to tinker around with pieces of tin that they made, another famous photograph you might have seen, and bring it all together, figure out the shape of DNA. Now that doesn't at all say how it works, but it allows, once you know the shape, then you can start figuring out how it works. 6, though, shows you the shape of a DNA. This is still only a tiny piece of the length, but now we can see that it's made of 2 separate polynucleotides, or strands, held together non-chemically, not covalently, but non-chemically. These purple ellipses represent how the two strands are held together, which are hydrogen bonds. Okay? So the overall structure of DNA is described as a double helix. A helix is a corkscrew shape. Each individual strand of the two is a helix, like one corkscrew. But because the other one is a helix as well, and they're next to each other, it's a double helix. It's very much like a twisted ladder or a spiral staircase, same thing, where the blue bands here represent the sugar phosphate backbones. So the sugars and the phosphates aren't shown here for simplicity, but they're what are making up each of these blue bands. All right, so those are connected to the variable parts, which are the nitrogenous bases. Once again, those nitrogenous bases are not holding each strand together. They're just hanging off of the strand, just like the R groups in a polypeptide are not holding the polypeptide together. They're hanging off of the backbone. And each nitrogenous base hanging off of this spiral or helix is forming half of a step in the ladder or staircase. The other half of that same step is formed by a nitrogenous base hanging off of the other sugar phosphate backbone. And that's how it appears in reality. It's a double helix. But you can mentally untwist this, right? Just imagine untwisting the ladder, and that will give you what you see in the middle here. It's a normal ladder with two vertical parts and the rungs or the steps of the ladder. You can see that each step is made from a pair of nitrogenous bases, one from each of the two backbones. Now, before I forget to say this, I mentioned this a little bit earlier. I said that each of the two polynucleotides has a 5' end and a 3' end. But when the two get together to form an overall DNA, the 5' end of one strand is next to the 3' end of the other strand, and vice versa. So that head-to-tail arrangement is given a special name. We say that DNA is anti-parallel. The anti-parallel arrangement refers to the head-to-tail arrangement of the strands. Okay, now, another thing that you see by just this little section of the ladder, but it would be true for the entire ladder, however long it is that it's not, even though for one strand, the sequence can be anything you want. It could be all C's, all A's, anything. There are no rules about what has to occur next to another nitrogenous base within one strand. But there are rules about which nitrogenous bases can pair with which nitrogenous bases on the other strand. And notice that it's A with T here, and T with A. It's also C with G, and G with C. It's not C with A or T. It's not G with A or T. It's C and G go together always, and A and T go together always. And this is really important, because DNA wouldn't work for what it's doing if it weren't for this fact. Word we use to describe the fact that the nitrogenous base of one strand goes along with only a specific nitrogenous base on the other strand is called complementarity. And that's with an E, not an I. Or the adjective would be complementary. But with an I, complementary means you give someone a compliment. Right? Complementary means that the two undo each other in a sense, or they have opposite, like in set notation. You have an overall set, you have a subset in it. Well, the complement of that subset is everything else in the set. Well, anyway, complementarity for DNA refers to the fact that A always goes with T in the other, T always with A, C always with G, G always with C. Now, I'll explain why DNA would not be able to do its job if it weren't for this complementarity in a bit. Okay, now, in 7, we need to review, or actually, I don't even know if it's review. I don't know whether I talked about this yet or not. There are 4 nitrogenous bases that DNA uses. That's review. But even though there's 4 overall nitrogenous bases, we can lump them into 2 categories based on the number of rings that they contain. All 4 of these nitrogenous bases has a ring, but 2 of them have 2 rings, and 2 of them have only 1 ring. All right? The 2 categories are called purines and pyrimidines. I don't think I did talk about this yet, did I? Okay. Purines and pyrimidines, which are easily confused because they both start with P and they you don't really know anything by the words about what they refer to. But I'll say more about that in a little bit. Anyway, purines are the two nitrogenous bases that have 2 rings in them. So purines are wider molecules or parts of molecules than pyrimidines are. Pyrimidines are the two that have just 1 ring. So they are narrower, not as wide as the purines. Well, about this time there was a guy called Chargaff who was studying DNA because it was such a hot topic once these discoveries were made. And he was getting samples from all over the place, all kinds of organisms, all the major groups of eukaryotes, bacteria, anything he could find, he would chemically test the DNA from. And despite the huge variety of organisms, what Chargaff found is that when he tested the DNA from any of them, it always had the same amount of purines as it had pyrimidines. And this shows you why that makes sense. If you're building a ladder, a standard ladder, with just parallel vertical styles, or whatever the parts of the ladder are that are vertical, that means all the rungs have to be the same width, right? Or the same length to fit that same width of the ladder. Well, if you allow 2 purines at the same position, 1 on each strand, to come together to form a rung, it's going to be wider than one made up of 2 pyrimidines. And you would have a zigzag ladder. On the other hand, if you have to have a purine always with a pyrimidine, then it doesn't matter which side, left or right, has the purine and which has the pyrimidine. It's always going to add up to the same width. So that explains so-called Chargaff's rule, which is always the same amount of purines as pyrimidines. And that fact, that purine number always equals pyrimidine number, partly explains complementarity. Explains why you don't have adenine pairing with adenine, right? Or thymine with thymine. It's part of the complementarity. But there's 2 purines and there's 2 pyrimidines. So if the only rule is purine with pyrimidine always, you could have a purine with either of the 2 pyrimidines. So it wouldn't be strict complementarity. It would only be partial complementarity. Real DNA, though, has strict complementarity. So it's not simply purine with pyrimidine. It's specifically adenine always with thymine and vice versa. Cytosine always with guanine. So we have to look at more than just what's explained here to explain strict complementarity. Let's look at the four nitrogenous bases. So the rest of the nucleotides are here. We're just ignoring the sugars and the phosphates. But in slide 8, we see adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. And I started telling you about the fact that purine and pyrimidine is easily confused. I could never remember which ones were which until it dawned on me one day that the word pyrimidine has a Y in it. Just like cytosine does and just like thymine does. So if that helps you, remember that thymine and cytosine with their Ys are both pyrimidines, and the others that don't have Ys are the purines. Then use that. But what I was saying in the previous slide is that if you joined a guanine with a thymine, that would be one purine and one pyrimidine, and that would still be the right size of a rung in the ladder, but that's still not allowed, though, because it has to be A with T and G with C. Here is why. Adenine and thymine have two places on their molecule or on their structure that allows for hydrogen bonding, which are the pink dots. Whereas cytosine and guanine have three positions. They can make three hydrogen bonds. And that's why it is not just purine with pyrimidine, but it's strict complementarity. Strict complementarity is very important because of strict complementarity, DNA is able to accomplish one of its two major functions, which is replication. Replication is not just making new DNA. Replication is making an exact copy of the existing DNA. And if the only rules were purine with pyrimidine, that would be ambiguous. There would be two ways to do that for each nitrogenous base. There's only one way, though. So in 9, we can see the importance of strict complementarity. In this figure and in a bunch of other figures that we're going to look at from this book, the same color scheme is used. Darker blue indicates DNA that's already there before replication, and lighter blue indicates new DNA that's created in the replication process. Okay? But just look at this original DNA. And this is just part of the overall strand, but in this little piece, you see both strands, and notice that there is strict complementarity. C is always with G, A is always with T. Doesn't matter which side each letter is on, but they always pair up that way. Well, because of strict complementarity, all you have to do is show me one of these two strands, and I can tell you exactly what the sequence is in the other strand, right? Which I wouldn't be able to do if all I were told is that purine has to be with pyrimidine. Because of strict complementarity, you can hide this right half, and I can tell you that it's going to be C, T, A, G, T. Because that's the rule. That's why DNA is allowed to work for self-replication, or able to work. Because all you have to do is separate these two strands and read each one separately and use the strict complementarity rules to build a sequence that is complementary to the one you're reading. That's what's happening here in C. This strand in dark blue is being read. G calls for C, A calls for T, and so on. Same thing's happening with the other original dark blue strand. Same rules. And when you do that, you end up with two complete double-stranded DNAs that are identical to each other and that are identical to the original one. That's exactly what you need if the two cells that each of these copies is going into are going to be allowed to, or will keep this the cells alive. They have to have not only a library, it has to be the correct library, right? So without strict complementarity, DNA would not be able to self-replicate, which means we wouldn't be here. Organisms wouldn't be here in general. All right. Well, in 10, we're looking at three, and it's the three. This is an exhaustive list, logically speaking, of the possible ways in which DNA replication could occur. This is before we knew how it occurs. But it has to be one of these three, logically speaking. And they are called the conservative model, semi-conservative model, and dispersive model. Once again, dark blue represents the original DNA, light blue, the new stuff. A fully conservative model is so named because the DNA that's in there originally, the dark blue, remains there all the time. Okay, so in the conservative model, you have a double dark blue strand that, because of complementarity rules, creates a double light blue strand, but you still have the original dark blue strand, double strand. It is conserved, in other words. Okay? Semi-conservative conserves one entire strand, but not both of them. So in the semi-conservative model, the next generation, each of the two double strands is one strand of original material and one strand of all new material. Okay? You see that? Well, the dispersive model is the only other possibility, and it's the least likely to be true because it is the most complex. And usually, in nature, the easiest things to occur are the things that do occur. But it's still a mathematical possibility, so they had to consider it. In the dispersive model, no strand is conserved as original. You have both strands, the strands are separated from each other, and each of those two strands gets broken into pieces, and a new strand is formed by some old material and some new material. Each strand is partially dark blue and partially light blue. Unlikely, but it is actually a possibility. So since this is an exhaustive list, no other possibilities, it's just a matter of devising an experiment to test which of these ones actually happens. And that's what slide 11 is all about. They used labeling in this as well, but this was not radio labeling because they weren't using radioactive isotopes. They were using isotopes, though, different isotopes of nitrogen. And since isotopes differ in their number of neutrons, that means a nitrogen with more neutrons is going to have more mass, be heavier. So this kind of labeling allows them to separate things centrifugationally. All right? And what they did was they used bacteria because of the cell cycle for a typical bacterium is only 20 minutes. A cell lives 20 minutes before it divides into two new cells. So they could get a bunch of cell cycles going in a short amount of time. But each cell cycle involves the S phase, remember. That's when new DNA gets created. They had to have enough to work with, so they used these bacteria. And what they did was allow them to go through two generations, so two cell cycles, and then they centrifuged the examples. They switched them from heavy nitrogen to light nitrogen, so there's two different sources of nitrogen. And then they centrifuged them. Now, each of the three models has a prediction associated with it. If the conservative model were true, you would always have some DNA that's fully original material, double dark blue, and some that's double light blue. And therefore, when you centrifuge it, you should see two layers form. Right? Because some of it's going to be heavier and some of it's going to be lighter. Well, right away they did not see that. So, just in right away they discounted the conservative model as being true. But the problem was that both the semi-conservative model and the dispersive model have the same prediction after one generation. Each one will have DNA that's half new material and half old material. And therefore, you should have just one layer in the centrifuge tube, but the other model has exactly the same results, or should. And so one round, one generation was not enough to tell the difference between semi-conservative and dispersive. But if you go one more generation after that, then the predictions are different for semi-conservative and dispersive. Semi-conservative is going to turn in the second generation into two layers, because you have part one DNA that has original strands and new strands, and the other ones are completely new strands. They really should have used three colors here. This would be dark blue and medium blue, and this would be medium blue and light blue, but both medium blue and light blue are the same, using the same isotope, so they're the same weight. Okay? That's exactly what they saw. The dispersive model, you should continue to have just one layer. It should just get lighter and lighter, so higher and higher up in the tube. They did not see that. So that was a very well-designed experiment, too, to show that in truth, even though there's three possibilities, the actual way that DNA replication occurs is by the so-called semi-conservative model. And that's exactly what I was showing you in slide 9. Semi-conservative model is you read an entire original strand, you use the rules to build an entirely new strand complementary to it. They just demonstrated that that's actually what's happening. Okay, 12 is the beginning of the process of DNA replication. And we're far enough along that since this is a pretty big change in topic, I will stop there and see you downstairs.